The brothers Wiss. The brothers Wiss, brothers Wiss. The brothers Wiss. The brothers.
You're now listening to Greg. It's the Brothers Wisp. Let's take a ride.
Hey, everybody. This is Greg with the Brothers Wisp number 121. I am excited. I don't know. It's like my excitement level goes up with the number of guests we have, especially when we have ones from really far away. I get especially tingly in my bits. So today with us, we have Andrew Thrift all the way from Australia. Are you still in Brizzy?
I am. I'm still in Brisbane. I'll never leave, mate.
Not even to visit? You're not going to go back home to say hi?
Yeah, I'll go back home if they'll let me. Still locked down at the moment. I've got to go into a two-week mandatory quarantine at my own cost if I go back. So.
Gotcha. Not worth it.
Yeah.
I get it.
No, not worth
it. Yeah, I don't like my family that much either, so I'm with you, bud. I get it. All right, so we also have... I'm going to point straight down because that's where Tommy Krogan is on the overlay. Krogan. Tommy Krogan.
Hey, everybody. I'll never correct you.
I screw it up every time. All right. We also have Mikey. Oh, he's that way from Chicagoland.
Hey, how's it going?
All right. I think you start the podcast with that same one because my wife is like, she'll as I'm editing these things, right, I have to play it back and back and back to synchronize the audio stuff. And it's just, hey, how's it going? And she'll walk by and go, hey, how's it going? So for like the next 20 minutes... I'll just hear her say, hey, how's it going? Hey, how's it going? Yeah, that's how you get tired of it. Anyway, I digress. So we have a lot of great faces. Andrew's, I think he's going to correct the record because we like to misquote him constantly. That's his own fault for popping in and giving great information but not ever following up with us. I mean, you can't trust
us. That's good. The seagull maneuver, I fly in, I poop, and I take off again.
Is that what it is? I saw a video, like a viral video, of somebody's cell phone getting snatched by a seagull and taken off. Woo! It's pretty amazing. And then there's this new trend where people like bury themselves in the sand and put a towel over them and wait for a seagull and then like catch them in the towel. So I don't know where that was going, but feel free to file that one away. All right, so let's get our sponsorship out of the way. We have our normal sponsors, and next week, well, not next week, but starting next cast, we're going to have an additional one, and we'll talk about them here in a moment. But this go-around, we have Cambium with their EPMP bundle. I'm going to see how fast I can get through this one. So it's a $2,000 price tag, $6,000 value. We get 6 months of VISP automated billing along with that. That's you know, that's going to take care of your cost as well as kind of your provisioning, things like that. You got also some RF Elements twist horns. You get 2 hours of one-on-one with an EPMP engineer, no sales pitch, and then you get a free trial of CN Heat. We've got a link down in the doobly-doo, and virtually everybody you're going to talk to likes Cambium, so give them a look. We also have Sonar, sonar.software, scalable, intuitive, and comprehensive ISP billing system. So go to sonar.software, check those cats out. We're actually going to be doing a cast. I hit up Simon. So Simon owns and operates Sonar. And he said, just pick a date and we will schedule it. So now I just need to arrange everybody together and then we can get on a cast for that guy. But I mentioned there's going to be another upcoming sponsor. So we did a sponsored podcast with QuickBit. They do 60 gigahertz equipment. Really cool looking stuff. I can't wait to get my hands on it. They're about to launch their store, so you're going to be able to get in there and actually grab some kit pretty soon. And the sponsored podcast, I think it's going to be going out this Thursday. So it's already recorded, edited, in the can, ready to go, up on the site. So look forward to that one because it's pretty cool. I think they're going to come in hot and do some damage. I think you're going to wreck shop on the 60 gigahertz front. So that's pretty neat. Let's see. You guys ready to jump in? Get going with the things? All right,
sure.
Rock and roll. So I just had a little bit of news. Ansible Fest is coming up next week. So for any of you guys that constantly hear me talking about automation, it's free this year. I think they're doing it for a couple of days. And you can pop in. They have lots of various kind of like little demos, workshops that you can jump in on. I know they do a lot of live workshops in these things where you can jump in and actually do some training. I'm not sure if those spots are still available, but the spots to actually see stuff happen is, and so I'm going to be hanging out there. Evidently, at Red Hat, everybody likes to tell me about all the cool stuff I don't get to participate in now that COVID has hit, and I keep reassuring them, you really don't have to keep telling me about all the things I'm missing out on. It's perfectly fine to just let me not know that, you know, because they're talking about how much fun it is to go to these events because, you know, they get a ride out there, they get to interact with clients and, you know, potential clients, which to me is baller. I think Thrift is probably in the same boat, you know, it's really energizing when you get an opportunity to, you know, get out there and perform and do that stuff. But then also you're at a cool place and you get to have a lot of fun with your friends. So sounds like the mum to me. So there you go. So pop in, take a look. Let's move on to some of the interesting bits, because I want to get Thrift talking. That's the whole reason we do these things, is that eventually he'll pop on and then, you know, it'll energize everybody long enough until he shows up again. You know, it's like when your dad goes out for milk and he comes back 6 months later. You know, you just can't wait for that next time he comes back, holding your breath. Oh,
comes
man.
Comes back with cigarettes and beer.
Yeah, there you go. So, I think it was the last podcast we were talking about the 30. So, we've been talking about various hardware platforms having strange problems. And it seems like, you know, Thrift takes for granted that we all understand these things and we know about them. And then he'll drop a little knowledge bomb and a bunch of people's minds will explode, you know, and melt out of their ears. So one of the ones was, we were talking about the 3011s. It's the ASIC. It's like the switch chips they have in there. There's a speed mismatch problem, right?
Yeah. So that product was one of the first that MikroTik made, where it had dual links from the switch chips into the processor, so the ARM processor. So there's two switch chips and they have two uplinks from them, one to each core effectively in the system on a chip that's inside it. Now, there's been a historical problem that's been going on ever since that product launched, as far as I know anyway, where if you mix, say, 1 gig ports and 100 megabit ports on the same switch chip, so either on ports 1 to, I think, 5 and then 6 to 10, the other ports on that switch chip will start flapping. And this product's been, problem's been pretty widespread, but only if you hit that particular edge case. But a lot of WISPs are hitting that because they might have an IP camera that's only got 100 megabit port on it, or they might have an older link or an old EMX link or something like that that's only got 100 meg ports. Now, this has been talked about on the MikroTik forums for a long time, and there was no real problem with it. I think the topic's called port flopping on RP3011 or something along those lines. But a few releases ago, I noticed there was a note in the changelog to say that they'd changed a flow control setting inside the software. And it looks like what the problem has turned out to be is that flow control was hard enabled to the ports back to the system on a chip. Yeah, so whenever traffic was going between ports via the SOC, it was causing the ports on the switch to flap. And MikroTik have found out what was causing that and they look to have resolved it. Now, I've tested it in my lab here and it does indeed look to be resolved, but my lab's what, 3 RB3011s, I can't really test it as well as what a lot of the WISPs out there can, so it'll be quite interesting to hear in a few months what people's results are with the new software.
I think, what is it, version 646 and on, it's the going to the switch chip itself. I'm not sure if it's available via the GUI, but it's interface Ethernet switch, set switch 1 and 2, CPU flow control to no. And supposedly it'll resolve this, right?
Yep.
Excellent. All right, cool. So don't forklift your 3011s. There's a simple fix. Potentially, right?
Yeah. And I'll add, those are one of the more stable products out there. Like, they're pretty powerful for a WISP pop or a hilltop or something like that, and plenty of grunt to run PPPoE servers and the likes.
All right, so also we've been talking mad trash, throwing a lot of shade about the ARM processors, and you are always quick to correct us that it's not all of the ARMs, it's just a handful, right?
Yep, which is basically an extension of what I was just saying. So all of the Qualcomm ARM processors, so the RB3011, the HAP AC squared, the HEP AC cubed, what else is there, the CAP AC, all those products are Qualcomm ARM based and they're stable. The products that seem to have the problems are the Annapurna ARM based products at the moment, which are the RB4011, the RB1100AHX4, as well as the new CCR2004. Now, I'm not sure if those are all related to each other, the problems on them, but they seem to be specific to that platform.
Gotcha. So while we're talking about the 2004, Chad in the chat, he's been having a lot of problems with it. Well, I mean, there's been a handful of people that have been having a lot of problems with the 2004s, but he's been working heavily with MikroTik. So he ran some special debug firmware, and then I think they have him on 648 beta 40 right now, and he said since loading that he hasn't had any reboots. I believe Joe was saying the exact same thing. He hasn't been running it quite as long, but they both reported that the amount of time they're at, I believe, is double what they would have normally gotten out of it prior. So
it's pretty good.
Not to say it's repaired, but it sounds like they're making headway, which is really good. I'm especially excited for the fact that it was a software fix, right, as opposed to a hardware issue, because there's not a lot of coming back from that, right? But if it's some software configurations that they can tweak and tune. You have any anything else you want to add to that?
Yeah, so not particularly to the 2004. I mean, it's a given that a platform that new and that different is going to have some teething issues. Mm-hmm. So kind of you get what you buy, kind of. Yeah. But the RB4011, I have seen some murmuring about the issues with that being resolved in a revision 2 of the hardware. So quite a few reports of that on the forums and on Facebook groups and Slack groups and that sort of thing. So it looks like there is a revision 2 of that hardware that does resolve it. Now, I'm not sure if that means it's a hardware problem or not, because it's all really hearsay until MikroTik confirm that that is the case. But it does seem like it. Now, the problem with those platforms seems to be, well, it is, that when you've got traffic passing through it, you'll lose management access, so you won't be able to winbox to the platform, but it will continue to pass traffic. But if you connect into the platform using a serial port console, all of a sudden your management access will come back, which sounds to me like a software issue, but it's kind of odd that people are saying that the hardware revision fixes it. So we'll see what comes out of it.
That's interesting. So I think it was Mike who put on here FQ, Kotal, and Cake Rumors. Is that you, Andrew?
I put that on
there. Oh, okay, there you are.
Yeah.
Well, tell us about that.
Yeah. So for quite a while now, people have been begging MikroTik to add these two features, which are called FQ, Kotal, and Cake. Now, what those are they are active queue management systems. So just like you normally have your P-FIFO or your FIFO queue on MikroTik or a PC queue, these are a more advanced version of those where you don't have to set anything. They effectively look at the traffic going through the queue and they'll dynamically create sub-queues and then adjust the delay on those queues to make sure that your traffic passes through really well. So it means that when you're downloading, or when a user's downloading a large torrent or they're watching YouTube and maxing out a link, that pings and time-sensitive traffic like gaming will continue to perform really well. And the main feature of them, though, is that they are basically zero touch. So you set them up and then they do everything on their own. So, yeah, people have been begging MikroTik for a long time for those features, but they were restricted by the kernel version on RouterOS version 6. But now that RouterOS version 7 is running a very recent kernel, I think they're running 5.6 now on them, they're able to add these features. And a few of the MikroTik staff have been posting on the forums a few cheeky hints that it may be coming in the next release of RouterOS v7. So if they do release that, it's going to be pretty good for the WISP industry. Generally, people will run these particular queue mechanisms on CPE, but you can run them centrally. And a lot of products that are on the market that say they provide quality of experience, all they're doing is running FQ Kotal on a big x86 server, pumping all your traffic through it and letting it do its magic. So you'll now be able to do that on RouterOS version 7.
Yeah. Very cool.
So it's very cool. So the difference between the two queuing options you've got there, FQCoddle and Cake. So Cake is just a more modern version of FQCoddle. It takes into account things like DSCP tags, and it also has a more efficient path, I guess. The code path is much more efficient than FQCoddle, so it will perform better. Now, both of these, you've got to be aware, just like any queuing, it is done in software, so it uses the CPU. So it's also going to be pinned to one CPU per queue. So you want to make sure that you're, if you're doing large amounts of traffic, that you're running it on devices with high core clock speed. So CCR2004s or on CHRs, x86 servers.
Rock and roll.
So is that, you're saying one core per queue?
Correct.
What if I were to do a queue per customer, and then it would might be more beneficial to have more cores?
What you'd do is you'd most likely create queues and then use some sort of mangle rule for a block of customers, because the whole point of FQCoddle and Cake is to not require a queue per customer.
So then will those possibly be able to support customers having IPv4 and IPv6?
Yes, they do
as well.
Yeah.
Okay, because that's the big issue with the current like system for mangling and tagging stuff is there's no good way to, between the IPv6 firewall and the IPv4 firewall, to combine a customer into a bandwidth limiting as one person.
That's a different problem. Yeah. I'm not sure about that.
Yes.
Yeah, that's not a FQCoddle problem. These are really just about optimizing jitter and latency to provide a good user experience.
So I'm...
Okay, because that was the...
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I'm fairly unfamiliar with them. Are they mature? Have they been out there?
Very mature.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have. So if you're running a Netgear router or a Ubiquiti, one of their small boxes at home, you're already running it. Yep. So it's on most consumer routers today. And it's kind of surprising that MikroTik haven't put this into their product earlier, to be honest, because there was so much demand for it. Yeah.
Right.
But it's a bit of a game changer. It really just makes things work. It's like magic.
What's far between? Go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say, so then you were saying that, you know, some of the point is to not have to create a queue per customer. But if you did, you would have similar, configuration and setup complexity is now.
That's right.
But a better quality of experience.
Exactly right. Yeah.
So it would be better, just you're not using all the advantage by, you know,
yes,
saving per customer
but
stuff.
The other thing there, Mike, is that each queue is only aware of its own contents. So if it's only got one customer going through it, it's only going to, analyze that one customer's traffic. Whereas if you've got a single queue with multiple customers going through it, it's going to look at all of the traffic and it's going to optimize it for all of the customers.
Okay, so you would choose it to, you'd want to manage a customer or an access point or, one sort of limitation domain.
That's right. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of, like anything on MikroTik or in Linux in general, there's a whole bunch of different ways you can configure this, and I guess the main use case is to put it on CPEs, but certainly for WISPs, there'll be an advantage of running it somewhere in the core and maybe hairpinning traffic through it using OSPF to optimize performance.
Very interesting. Okay. So a minute ago, you mentioned version 7. I know they just put out a new version 7 video in relation to routing. I was curious what you think of the progress so far.
I think it's pretty good. I mean, I've got to be realistic here. You always want it to be kind of finished and perfect and do everything that they've always said, but reality is this is a complete rewrite from scratch, and like the amount of complexities in developing a routing engine, in particular the race conditions, which any developer will understand, must be just horrific with it. So yeah, progress is pretty decent. I've been playing with it a bit over the last fortnight, and it's still pretty rough around the edges. I think in particular, they really need to take a look at the workflow, so how users configure things, because people use RouterOS, and the reason why it's got such a large market share is because it's really easy to configure quite complex things on it. And version 7 is making it that significantly harder. So removing things like BGP networks and OSPF networks, OSPF configuration types like the interfaces and networks and stuff, makes it really confusing. If you've come from Juniper or Cisco or RouterOS version 6, it's just really confusing. So the barrier to entry and the amount of things you need to learn is quite high. So one of the things I picked up on and straight away is that for you to configure a BGP peer, it's mandatory that you use a template now. Now that is just so confusing. Yeah. And the way that they call the peers connections is also extremely confusing. I think they need to do something similar to what Juniper and Cisco have done, where you can configure peers and you can assign a template per peer if you want to. Or what OpenBGPD has done, where you define a peer with a wildcard for the neighbor address or a wildcard for the neighbor AS number, and it uses those to create dynamic peers. Because the way it is currently is just confusing. Like, I understand why they've done it, but I think there's got to be a better workflow for it.
Mm. When you say you understand why they've done it, do you think it's because it matches exactly how the engine's taking and consuming that information? Is that... where do you think it's coming from?
I think they've looked at the user requests, and there was quite a lot of requests to have dynamic peers, and the easiest way for them to think to do that is to force everything to use a template. That way, if a peer is completely dynamic, e.g., you want to make it so it'll accept any AS number, as long as the template doesn't have the AS number filled out or it has a wildcard, it's going to accept it, and it will just appear as a connection.
What's an example of when you would want to have a dynamic BGP peer?
So if you're running a route server or a route reflector, in particular on like an internet exchange or something like that, it's pretty useful to be able to accept that. Even if you're peering on an internet exchange and you don't want to have to set up bilats manually every time, you could set up a template to accept any AS number from any peer, as long as it's within the IP range that's on the internet exchange, and it will then accept peering requests straight away and they'll come up.
That feels kind of niche to me.
I'd probably do it, to be honest, just to make things easier on myself. But I'd apply some pretty hefty route filters on that, to be honest.
Just the idea of having dynamic BGP peers makes my palm sweat a little bit.
The room for human error is just massive on that one. I don't think they thought this all the way through.
Well, no, it's kind of like it's the Jurassic Park thing. You know, I think the scientists were so busy to see if they could do it, they didn't stop to think if they should. I guess that makes sense. It totally makes sense. It feels like if you make such a hard right turn from what the rest of the industry is doing, you're gonna isolate yourself a little bit. Because sometimes I've introduced so many people to MikroTik, right? When you show something to like a Cisco guy or like you said, a Juniper guy or really virtually everybody else, that's why they call it kind of an industry standard CLI, because it sort of, it sort of feels and fits that same way. And, you know, like when you're configuring OSPF, you can jump into MikroTik and you understand the concepts pretty quick. I mean, all the knobs are in different places, but the concepts are the same. And so if you completely rewrite the playbook entirely, it seems like it's going to be harder for me to convince folks to get in there and start using this stuff.
Exactly right. Yeah, this kind of reminds me. The way they've done it reminds me of using an older Allotelisys router or a Lucent or one of those products that has disappeared from the market for this reason. Yeah.
Interesting.
Just too different.
All right. So now,
now
I'm going to ask you about the video itself. So I think it's, what do you think about the concept of them starting to record stuff And why isn't Giannis recording every video? That's what I want to know.
Giannis is a busy man. He's got more important things to do.
That sounds like excuses to me.
I think the videos are a great idea. They should have done it years ago, to be honest. And I think some of them, what, they've released three or four so far?
I think four, because I think it's three products and then one, the routing video.
Yeah, so most of them are pretty good. The routing one is pretty hard going, just because the guys on it are not that confident in front of the camera, or maybe the content is too technical and they're trying not to forget it. But it's still got a lot of very good information in it. As long as you can stick with the video and watch it all the way through.
So this is Andrew Thrift officially saying that he's willing to sit down with me and we'll record all these MicroTik videos for them. They just need to reach out to us and let us help us to help you. Come on, let us do it. That could be fun.
Be good fun.
I'd be willing to just voice coach those guys.
I
public speaking is difficult and it's hard, but oh man. I would they're both really intelligent. You can tell the guy who's explaining stuff, he just knows it out of the back of his hand, and he just is like, but you just need a couple lessons and you will be able to knock it out of the park and you'll be like some amazing superhero.
I feel kind of bad too, because it's amazingly technical. They're very brilliant guys, but it's not their native language that they're trying to do all this stuff. Right? It's all these things are stacked up against them. So I definitely feel
bad. Yeah.
But I'd much rather they do it than pay like a voice actor or someone like that, because it's genuine. The content is genuine.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I like it. I like watching them squirm on camera too. That's fun.
It reminds me of when I was used to squirm in front of camera. Uh-huh.
That's why we gotta
one
get
of the videos.
Giannis keeps teasing me that he's eventually gonna get on there. I'm not buying it. He needs to do it. Oh, he said maybe for a new product announcement. I said, oh, like that 100 gig thing that you guys are gonna come in. He said, I don't know what you're talking about. So we'll see.
It's almost a sure thing, isn't it? That product. Well, it's been on the cards for a few years.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they put it in a press release that they're building you put it in there, or rather, you put it in our Slack that they have 100 gig. Network they're going to be building, and it's going to be using MicroTik stuff. So it's like, you basically just, you said it, you just didn't put the part number on there, so whatever.
Maybe they've been pulling a fiber store, and when they're talking about their, 100 gig DWDM system, it just breaks 100 gig into 10 tens, and then sends that across. Maybe it's, he says, well, our 100 gig router with 10 gig ports. Technically, I suppose.
It gets the job done. Somebody posted something about the NetPower Lite 7R. What's the story on that? And the CSS 610?
Oh, yeah. That was me, mate. So those products, you guys talked about them a little bit on the last cast. Yeah. But I was just going to say something I picked up on that I hadn't noticed before. These have got yet another new switch chip. So they're not Qualcomm. They're not a Marvell Prestera, they're a Marvell Linkstreet. So these are a low-end SMB type switch chip that Marvell make. It's been around as long as I can remember. Like the first Marvell switches I used, I think, had these chipsets in them. Now they've got a tiny little CPU in them. I think it's even a little MIPS CPU. They can only run Switch OS, but they're quite powerful, like the amount of functionality on there. And what this kind of said to me is that now MicroTik have the ability to use these Linkstreet switch chips, which are pretty decent. Hopefully all of their products I've been using Realtek switch chips on go away and they replace them with these, because they're a lot better. I really don't like those Realtek switch chips that they've put in a bunch of the newer products. They are missing a huge number of features, so... Yeah, whereas these have got them, e.g. being able to rate limit on ingress and egress and hardware and stuff like that.
Very cool. And I guess if they've been around a long time, they're battle tested, right? So they are good to go.
Oh, they are. Yeah. I don't know if they've got the same software development kit as the Presteras or if there's some sort of complexity there, but hopefully it's as easy as possible for MicroTik to use these things.
But hopefully not at the downside of they all use Switch OS, because
there
probably won't be many
used. No, I mean, I'd never buy those products myself personally, because at Switch OS, there's no APIs, there's no TR69, there's nothing. But I mean, as a cheap Switch, I'm sure they're great, and for particular markets, they'll be fantastic. I was just more thinking that if they can use that Switch chip with the router OS-based devices, it's going to be a step forward over the current Realtek. Hopefully for a similar cost as well.
Mm-hmm. Very nice.
Does Switch OS support SNMP?
I think it does. I haven't played with it, though. Have you played with it, Greg?
I'm pretty certain it does. I thought it did because the G-Pen 21 we're using, and I don't know if I would have... You'd have pulled it, would have gone for it if it didn't have SNMP.
Mm.
So, which for me is like, that's the big management interface that I need. What I really would love though is if MikroTik would put two PoE out ports, so that you could have two different things you're powering from your seven different things that you can take PoE in from. But that's probably just...
Oh, you're talking about specifically on the G-Pen product.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, so like on the 7R, if it would get, if you have seven ports reverse PoE in and one PoE out, and so you can power another device like a CPE. So like the idea is that you have a backhaul connecting into like an MDU, and you can power the backhaul off of all those reverse PoE ports. They're all gigabit, all is life, it's wonderful, great stuff. But if you could have two antennas or two things that you can power on, it'd be absolutely perfect for a few different situations.
Mm.
But then you really kind of want SwitchOS too, because, or no, RouterOS, full RouterOS, just because that gives you a few other options and abilities. So
can you imagine how hard it would? Can you imagine how hard it would be working for a manufacturer, and everyone's got these little edge cases they want you to build products for?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's terrible. And then,
hey, like, yo, now that you made product XYZ, I would like to have two. So can you make one with two? And then I make two. Well, I want four. Can you make one with four?
Why do you have too many SKUs? It's so hard to figure out what I need from you.
Enough is never enough.
Yeah.
They should just make them software selectable. Are they inputs or outputs?
There we go. That would be ridiculously huge amount of work, I bet.
It would be, electrically.
Yeah.
It's not my work, so... I didn't sit here and ask for it. Then I'm moving on.
All right, Thrifty, did you have any other MikroTik nuggets before we move on to something else?
Does it include negative comments about products?
I would assume you can say whatever comment you want. This is a safe space.
One thing that amazes me is a lot of the products that they've released, the outdoor ones that are designed to go up on poles, have still got DC barrel connectors on them, yet other ones are using the Molex connectors. Just use the Molex connectors, guys. Right. The DC barrels are going to shake out, and you need multiple of them to handle the current, whereas a Molex connector is just going to hack it. It's just going to do it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So only use barrel connectors on Soho products.
Exactly right. Yeah. I mean, there's stacks of other connectors. If they've got some religious dislike against Molex connectors, there's like XT30s and XT60s. There's a bunch of better connectors that are not going to shake out on a pole.
I have a little bag over here of barrel connectors, like the female side, that actually have screw terminals. So you could include one of those if you insisted on keeping those. Just give them a little adapter and then, you know, stick with the Molex.
Convert it back to a barrel.
Yeah, if there is some edge case where somebody absolutely has to have it, just include a little adapter, and then, you know, that'll cost you an extra 10 cents, and it'll make everybody happy. Go to town.
Yeah, it's one of those things, like, on the RB1100AHX4, it's got the Molex connectors on the back, and I was like, cool, I've started to do Molex connectors, and then they released, like, three other products that have got the barrel connectors, and it's like, what are you guys doing?
They've got a whole stockpile of them. We got such a good deal, we got to get rid of them.
I wonder if it's, you know, different groups of people in charge of different groups of hardware, and only one of them likes thrift, so only one of them actually puts the connectors on that he wants.
It sounds like they need a benevolent dictator or something.
Oh, good times. So, While we're talking about a little bit of hardware, I put out, man, I love it. Dude, I love the hive mind that we have there in that Slack. I said, hey, I'm looking for a local SAN. So for these podcasts, each one produces at least 5 gigs to 8 gigs worth of stuff. And then my wife does like this fitness video stuff. And so she's spitting out like 10 gigs a week. And so I just want some local storage that I can then, you know, push out to the cloud some easy way. And so everybody and their dog told me to look at Synology and eventually settle on the DS920 Plus. And I actually have it plugged in right over there in that rack. And it's not actually powered on yet. I just need to go push the button. It's about ready to configure. So I wanted to say thank you guys for all of the input, a ton of that. And so I was looking at, there's a lot of interesting stuff that came out of it. I saw that there's like a hard drive report put out by Backblaze, and they show the like the hard drive failure rates that they have across their organization. I thought that was really fascinating.
That's really fascinating, yeah. I've been watching that one for a while now. The bathtub curve, they call it.
The bathtub, yeah.
Yeah, where you get that huge initial failure rate on hard drives, and then it goes to almost nothing, and then after about 3 years, it just spikes, and they all start dying again.
But as you know, so as I was... Go ahead, Mike.
Oh, I was going to say that, like, my problem with the Backblaze report is, like I watched it for so long, and then one day I realized, I want to buy enterprise drives. I don't want to buy consumer drives. I'll gladly spend... I think last time I looked, it was like $20 per drive. I'll gladly spend $20 per drive more to get SaaS and to get twice the number of IOPS and to get other things. I'm like, so really doesn't do me any good other than telling me kind of, you know, how a brand does.
Yeah, but any brand's enterprise drives are going to be pretty reliable. Like, yeah. I remember years ago, the Seagate Barracuda 3s, they were terrible. Like, every single one I ever saw was dead. Whereas we were running like probably about 600 of their enterprise, the Barracuda ES3s, I think they were, and a SAN, and we had like no failures at all. They were solid.
Yeah, so. Yeah, I've heard that from a lot of folks. So that's what I went with. I got some enterprise drives. Plus, these things aren't going to be spinning that much. Like, I'm not really backing up to them very often, so they're just going to be idle most of the time. So they should last for virtually forever. But I also learned another term, is there was a couple of guys talking about shucking. I was like, what is that? Sometimes, so I used to have this problem where if I was completely oblivious to what they were talking about, I was embarrassed to say, what does that mean? I don't have that problem anymore, right? The only thing I know about shucking is like you do that with oysters, right? So you're going to open them up or whatever. Yeah. And so they told me that it basically means you wait for external hard drives to go on sale somewhere. You go and you get it and you just bust them out of their case and then throw that in the trash and then you got a hard drive. And they said most of the time the warranty remains even though you've shucked them, doing air quotes there. So that was interesting.
So the hard drive manufacturers caught on to this and they started making PCBs that only have a USB interface on them.
Oh, bastards.
Yeah. I bought a 2.5-inch drive. I think it was a Western Digital and opened it up just to see if they'd done that. And yeah, it was USB only.
Oh, man, that's jacked, bro.
Does
so it costs them more to make it now because they have to make a special PCB
yeah
just to thwart you from chucking,
but then they can charge you more to buy a beer drive.
Yeah honestly, like Mike said, I've gotten to the point in my life where I don't mind paying an extra $20, right? To get something that's gonna be reliable,
to not have to mess around with it.
I'm so old and I have no patience anymore and I just don't want to deal with stuff. I just want it to work and be reliable and not think about it. I don't know. I don't know where that comes from. I think it's just the burnout of IT. You just get tired of jacking with stuff. But it is what it is.
When you're young, you don't care, though. It's all an adventure. You're like, yeah, I'm learning something.
Yeah, you've got time. You've got nothing but time because you don't have any money. You can't go do stuff. Well, I mean, shit, can't go do stuff right now anyway because we're all in quarantine. But, you know, it's like back then I couldn't afford anything, so you have to duct tape it all together. I don't know. It's a different time.
And that's how you learned about Microtech.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, it's you know, I used to build servers. Like, I would buy a 4U case and then buy a motherboard. And buy a CPU, and buy a fan, and buy this and buy that. And now it's just, you know, which Dell server is close enough to what I want? eBay, type that up. Okay, $1,000.
Yeah.
Done. Yep. Moving on. You know, I bought, it was, I don't know, it was maybe four years ago or so now. I bought like five or six Dell R900s and then another five or six Dell 2950s. I had no use for the 2950s. They just came along for the ride. All of that was $600. So it's like I would spend more time trying to figure out what components I would want to put into a server than just buying 10 assembled servers.
We just built the Red Hat lab that we're using. So the SSAs here in Central Pod, we've got our own lab that sits in a data center, and it's all eBay servers and like hard drives off of Amazon. Like it's just, I mean, it's just, and so we're even talking to other pods about, hey, yeah, this is, here's our cut sheet. This is everything we ordered off at eBay. And they're like, oh, that's fine. Half of what we have already is off of eBay. It kind of trips me out. I guess this is, this is the Mandalorian would say, this is the way. So there you go.
One thing I've noticed is that if you choose hardware that's quite common for HPC clusters or cloud providers, it pops up quite regularly for dirt cheap because they bulk replace. Like they'll replace 20 racks worth of gear and just put the whole lot on eBay. And so that's why there's a lot of Arista switches out there and Extreme switches because they were in HPC clusters and they'll upgrade it to some new Ethernet standard and a whole lot ends up on there for dirt cheap.
All right. Well, Tommy C's got a book here in just a second. So let's burn down some of this data center stuff because he had some actually really good questions and got in there. So I worked for a data center group for 13 years. So coming into the data center, whenever I first started working there, I had never actually stepped foot in a data center before. So it was an all new experience. I didn't know anything about power. I didn't know anything about it. Honestly, anything as far as running a data center went. And to be honest with you, nobody else there did either. We were all pretty darn new. So we were kind of riding it as we went along. So it was trial and error, trial by fire. I don't know, whatever you want to look at it. So a lot of this stuff is hard-earned, and I can't speak for all data center organizations, just the ones that I had direct interaction with, right? I've bought space from other folks, and I've seen a lot of different people's quotes and things like that. So your mileage may vary on any of this information, right? Because everybody does a little bit different. So I just want to kind of put that caveat out there. By no means am I an expert in anything ever. So don't take this as legal advice or medical advice. Consult your doctor. But there are kind of a handful of tips that I would say anybody who's going into a data center, especially if you've never been into one, here's the kind of things to look out for. So I would say starting out, so I've got this monster list. I'm going to try and condense it down a little bit. How much power are you using on your equipment? That's probably the most important thing whenever you're going into a data center. Because you're going to talk to multiple people normally, right? Unless you're, I don't know, like in Hawaii, there's probably not a lot of diversity as far as what data centers you can use, right? You know, you really want to stick to that one geographic area. But here in the States, we usually have a lot. So I'm in Texas. So if you go to Dallas, I mean, you can't walk 5 feet without tripping over a data center down there, right? They're thick as fleas down there. So definitely get multiple quotes. But the only way you can really get true quotes is if you know what you need, right? You need those apples to apples comparisons. So definitely try and figure out how much power you're using. And don't just read the sticker on the back of your kit, right? Because your back of your servers, your network equipment, it's basically telling you max inrush power. Like how much can this power supply handle? It may not even really relate or pertain to the server that much. So I would say, if you can, put a meter on it. If you've got a metered PDU, that's probably going to be your best bet. Outside of that, most manufacturers actually have, so like your large server manufacturers are going to have power calculators where you can put in your hardware, put in what you've got in there, what your normal workload is, and it can usually give you kind of a fairly accurate, I mean, it's going to be in the ballpark. It's going to be close enough to where you can actually get a quote on something as far as power goes. So definitely try and be as precise as you can on your power utilization. So, oh, and also, guys, you have anything you want to add, just jump in there.
On the power thing, I would say that, yes, because that's where you're going to find probably the most variability and the most where you're going to need more later, because most networks aren't going to be filling up a rack of routers and switches because it's all deployed in the field. But if you decide that, you know, you're going to replace your, you know, CCR 1036 with a Juniper MX, you know, 480 or 960, that's going to have a different power requirement, and that's really going to make a big difference. And some facilities can't accommodate it. You know, Equinix in Chicago, we were trying to get a rack to move out of our old space for a better part of a year, and the only racks that were ever available for a long time was a single 20-amp feed. It's like, no, I need dual. So then finally, you know, when a dual 20-amp came up, we took it. But that was it, and there was no possibility ever of upgrading the single feed to a dual feed or upgrading to more than, you know, dual 20s in that cabinet. So if you bought yourself a big MX router, you know, you can't power it off.
Mike raises three really good points there. One is a lot of facilities are at capacity as far as power goes. And so you have to actually wait till a customer moves out and sheds a circuit before you can buy that. So that's definitely a question. How much capacity do you have left in this pod, in the data center as a whole? That's a really important one.
It is. That echoes my experience as well, guys. Yeah, like the other thing I've noticed is a lot of modern data centers, so built in like the last 5 or 6 years, they just use these giant extension cords straight from the breaker panel to above your rack. And that way, if you need more power, they can just run these giant extension leads and add more PDUs into the rack. Whereas a lot of the older data centers, they have fixed power, so you get what you get and you don't get upset.
Yeah, so we've seen that a lot, especially in carrier facilities, you know, where it's a telco, it's like a CenturyLink, or it used to be Level 3. They had some data centers where they had fixed power going into all the racks. And like you said, you get what you get, you don't throw a fit. So you also touched on multiple feeds. So some data centers can actually give you an AB power feed, right? And AB meaning you have a power that comes off of, say, one source, one UPS, different set of switch gearing comes to you, and then a B feed that's going to come from somewhere other location in the building, right? The idea is redundancy, because data centers are in a constant state of maintenance. So I've seen most failures happen in maintenance windows, or when they were performing maintenance of some sort, something crazy would happen unexpectedly. And so if your A feed falls off, well, you need to be supported by your B feed. So some data centers will give you that by default. So whenever you order power, they always look at it as you're getting AB. Some only sell you A side, and then there's an upgraded price and they'll sell you the B side. So definitely be aware, because I've seen some people go into those optional facilities anticipating AB feeds, and then you know, they get there to rack all of their kit and they're like, where's the second feed? And they're like, oh, you know, that'll just be another 20% of what you're paying, and we'll gladly install that additional power, right? So it's just be aware of what you're getting. And some people are okay with an A only feed, right? Say you have multiple pops that you're pulling connectivity and you just got a router in there and it can take a power hit and you're fine. Maybe you're okay with that. I've talked to some guys that are doing some high compute loads really quick. They're okay with dropping power. Bitcoin mining guys, a lot of times, they're okay with dropping power. They just want electricity, right? They don't care if you've got 100 hamsters running in a wheel to give it to them. They just need it for now.
Yeah. You know, or UPSs or generators or anyone else of the kind. It's how cheap can I get this power?
Done. And so whenever you're talking to folks, ask them, how does the power come into the building, right? They should be able to tell you that. Some people actually have the ability to pull from multiple substations, right? That's additional diversity. How many generators do you have? right? If you're getting an AB feed, you would anticipate an AB generator, right? Mm. Not everybody does that, and some people provide it in different ways. And then also, am I getting it off of an AMB UPS? Are those UPSs in the same room, right? So theoretically, if there's, say, I don't know, a fire event in the power room, if all of the UPSs are in one room, guess what's getting EPO'd? Your entire load, right? Some data centers will actually have multiple power rooms. So if there's an issue in one, like your A feed goes down, that whole room EPO's, no big deal. You're still supported by the B side. So a lot of the big data centers like Digital Realty, that's their default footprint, is for a data hall that you're going to have your equipment in. All the power distribution comes out of one room. So if there's an issue in that room and it EPO's, everything's gone. Also comes down to air conditioning redundancy. I have seen data centers where they've lost the chiller. I have personal experience with this. Where they've lost the chiller. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Have you? You know. And the room gets too hot. Well, guess what happens? As the temperature goes up, people's equipment starts turning off. And we didn't lose any of... No, we lost some of our network kit, but we didn't lose any of our backbones. I think we lost like a point-to-point switch that was providing some point-to-point services between facilities. But we had a myriad of customers that... equipment just got too hot and shut down, right? So even network equipment, even though it's designed for those higher temperatures, it's not going to last forever. And also in those higher heats, you're going to shorten the lifespan of your kit, right? Those electrolytic capacitors, they have so much life, and whenever you put a lot of heat on them, it's going to shorten that lifespan. Sometimes they pop. And I've seen it before where those electrolytic capacitors will pop and your equipment will keep running until you reboot it, and then it doesn't come back. So it may actually be a year down the road when you're doing upgrades that you actually find out that it didn't survive that heat event. So definitely ask about the air conditioning, ask about how the redundancy works. And also keep in mind, the more of these questions you ask, the more intelligent you're gonna seem to the vendor, and they're actually going to negotiate more with you. They're gonna give you a better price. I have 100% seen that. So if you come in more informed, you're asking more pointed questions, they're going to be more hesitant about trying to stick you with a big price tag, because they're going to be a little bit more apprehensive, a little bit more wary on that stuff. So I'm not saying you're going to get like a 50% discount, but you know, you can see some savings there. I also have... Go ahead, Mike.
A quick thing back on the power. Mm-hmm. A and B feeds. Just because you have 20 amps of A, 20 amps of B, doesn't mean you have 40 amps.
No.
You only have 16, really. And so don't put in, 35 amps worth of equipment and then wonder why it all turns off. Oh, Jesus.
If you do that, that is a failure on the sales team. They should clearly indicate all of that stuff ahead of time. You shouldn't find that out in the fine print after you're in a data center. And I... have seen it happen, and I would get pretty upset whenever that would happen, because it's the operations team that comes off with egg on their face, right? It's the guys actually putting that stuff in there. And as Mike said, we look at it, if you get an AB feed, we look at it as if you've only got a single feed, right? Because we're doing it as if you're in a failure scenario and we're trying to maintain that load, right? So trying to make it as reliable as possible. And also, part of fire code is whenever you have a breaker that's running a consistent load, right, a consistent amount of current through it, it actually changes the trip characteristics of said breaker, right? It heats up. So past 80% of the rating on the breaker, we can't guarantee what it's going to do. So data centers only allow you to use up to 80% of a breaker. So that's why when Mike said you think you've got 20 amps, actually you've only got 16, right? Because that's 80% of that 20 amp breaker.
The other thing I'll add is if your equipment doesn't have dual power feeds, you can get a device called an ATS, automatic transfer switch, from companies like WTI and APC, and it will take two feeds in and put one feed out. And that means if your A feed fails, your B feed will keep the equipment going. And I'd highly recommend that people put any extra blower fans or blower units onto those, as well as out of band routers and that sort of thing, Because if you lose a power feed and all your blowers go out, you might have some dead equipment as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what? And it's interesting you say that. We would always, anybody that was bringing anything single-legged in, we would always tell them the exact same thing. You're going to need to put an in-rack ATS in there, automatic transfer switch, right? That's just going to switch between power sources. We did, however, sell somebody three ATSs one time, and there was a bad run on manufacturing. And two of those three ATSs failed when we were doing some power maintenance one time, and that was bad. But I would also say, get an ATS that has monitoring on it, because ATSs generally are one of the more sensitive pieces of equipment you have in your rack. And so if you have an ATS in there with monitoring, and it flips service for any reason, technically it's going to be invisible to your equipment, but your monitoring will see it, and that's generally an indication of some shenanigans on the power feed. And you definitely want to call up data center group and ask them what just happened, because sometimes it'll be the harmonics will get a little bit out and it'll sense that and it'll switch, or some strange fluctuation I've seen before where UPS would have an issue with one of its capacitors inside, and it just, this weird aberration just kind of blasted through. Nobody's equipment really saw anything that we knew of, except for some ATSs switched over. You definitely want to, anything you're getting billed against or anything you're SLA'd against, find a way to monitor that. And so an ATS is a really good way of monitoring that power infrastructure. If you're getting PDUs, get metered PDUs. It's not that much more expensive. And if you can afford it, get metered PDUs that have individually controlled outlets. While a lot of data centers will do hands and eyes and go and flip a power supply on and off for you, it's really nice when you don't have to call them, right? If you can just pop in there and do it. I've had experiences with them rebooting the wrong server. And what happens if they accidentally go and reboot your database server when they're supposed to be just, you know, rebooting the web server, something like that? You can actually have data loss and things like that. So that's bad. It's nicer when you can take all that stuff into your own hands. And also, if you have those metered PDUs, you can keep the data center honest. You know, you can see if all of a sudden power goes down, and you can monitor how long it goes down, or you can measure harmonics and things like that. You can also capacity
plan. On the switched PDU thing, most data centers do have some sort of, you know, hands and eyes service, smart hands, but many of them charge you for it. They may charge you $300 to go power cycle that server. So would you rather spend $300 on a better PDU that has that capability, or $300 on one guy one time doing it?
You know, and the way I looked at it too was, if it's CapEx, right, a capital expenditure, it's this one time that I've got to put $300 on there, that's easier to explain to your management, to your CFO, than a $600 or $900 charge that shows up because you were having problems with a server or a piece of network equipment, you had to keep having them go up there and mess with it, right? Because that's something I never wanted to have to do, because I hated those calls. Like, I literally, at one point, we had a CFO that was riding me about like $3.30 or something on a charge. Like, he just had to 100% know, like, what was this deal story with that, you know? So it's, I never wanted to have to talk to that guy, because it was a black hole that you would fall into. And, you know, if I could save myself that trouble, I would absolutely do it. I would also, now that I'm saying that, another thing is documentation. Whenever you go into a data center, document the hell out of it. Make it's easy to make rack elevations. Use Excel, or use, you know, it doesn't have to be anything fancy. Use Sheets in Google and just put the equipment in the squares, right? If it's 2U, color it 2Us, and label where everything goes. Take pictures when you're done. That's amazing. If you have to call hands and eyes, send them a screenshot of your picture circling the thing you want them to reboot, right? Don't leave anything up to chance. That's really important.
On the pictures, some data centers let you take pictures, some data centers don't. Yeah.
Some data centers will take the picture for you, right? If they are like super locked down, so
yeah,
which is whatever.
I've been in data centers where on exit you have to show them the roll on your phone to make sure you haven't taken any photos. Yeah.
Do you slip any dick pics in just in the middle?
So, so you take the pictures, you throw them up to Dropbox, then you
delete
them off the local. It's like I ain't got anything. I know, but I've found, also they're not exactly evenly lit. So if you take pictures, your phone may not be the best device to use. You may want to get a real camera. And then you might want to get a real camera with a real wide lens, because you're not going to be able to stand 12 feet away from it because you're going to be in somebody else's equipment. So I've got a T6i on a wide lens, and I can stand 2 feet from the equipment and take a picture, and I get most of the rack.
My pro tip there is to get one of the step ladders and stand up slightly above the rack, and if you take a photo looking down on an angle, you can usually get the whole thing.
I usually just take a picture, move down a little bit, take a picture.
And you can be above the camera then, too.
I usually take multiple series of pictures just so I can get good detail on them. So one of the next things I had on the list was kilowatt hour billing. Tommy asked about that. Metered billing is what we used to call it. What sparked that in your question there?
So the data center that I'm looking at least the one that I was getting quotes and stuff from, that's what they just offer by default. Oh, nice. I guess, which is which seems fire enough to me, because I'm looking at using Microtech equipment. I'm not going to use as much power as some joker with a bunch of Cisco and Juniper gear or somebody running a bunch of servers. So that was that kind of a benefit to me, and maybe I didn't talk about it precisely, but they have, so the total of the whole bill, it's not just the power cost, it's the whole bill actually increases every year by that 3% or something like that. I was like, so that was actually a question I have, is like, is it being petty to say, hey, I want you to increase this at a year of me having a contract with you, not, a month into me being in your data center. That's why you have accountants.
Gotcha. I think so those are two really good things, and I have answers to both of them. For kilowatt hour billing, in most of the data center facilities I went to, it was an option, but only for bigger customers. And the reason for that is most data centers will sell you, like Mike said, a 208-20. And when I say 208 volts, I'm talking about the voltage 208-120. I always recommend going with a 208 because your power runs more efficiently, or your equipment runs more efficiently at 208. So if you think about it, your watts, it's amps times volts, right? So if you're running at 120 and you're using 10 amps at 208, you're going to be running at 5 amps, right? So it's less load on your equipment. Technically, you can load up those 208s, and usually the price increase on a 208 versus a 120 is nominal. So look at that if you can do it. Most of your equipment can support it. Those that don't seem to, they sometimes on the power supplies will have a manual switch. You got to kind of switch it over, and then it does 208. So definitely check your equipment before you go that route. But on the kilowatt hour billing, if it was a big customer, they could negotiate it, right? Because they have the power to negotiate at that point. But the smaller guys, if I sell you a 208-20, you're only going to be able to use 16 amps. Most people, to be perfectly honest, are only going to use maybe 50% of that 16 amps. So they're maybe going to use 8. So all that stuff that's left over, you're still paying me for that. If I'm paying you, or rather if I'm charging you a flat rate for that whip. So it behooves me to not give you metered billing, because I'm going to make a lot more money off of it. Now, those bigger guys, they're still going to be running at those levels, right? So, some of their equipment is going to probably be high performance or big storage arrays or something like that. They're going to pull the power. They're actually going to use it. But a lot of their kit, it's not, especially overnight, right? It's like their users are at home asleep. That stuff's just not cranking away. So if they're using kilowatt hours, they're going to save themselves a lot of money. Technically, the data center wants to sell them just a flat rate on those whips so they can make even more money. But most of these guys have been around the block long enough to know that they're going to save money going that route. So that's normally what I've seen, at least. So I think it's cool that by default, those guys do the kilowatt hour stuff for you. As far as the rate increases go, you said, does it seem imprudent, maybe, of you to ask for anything? I have never once seen a contract that didn't have red lines. And with my carriers, I've never once not made them change something in the contract. So they'll ask for the moon. You know what I mean? It's like, if you sign it, great. They're not worried about it. But they anticipate you saying various things. Like on my circuits, all of my bandwidth circuits, they would always have auto-renew clauses at the end of the term, right? So if you sign a three-year, it'll auto-renew for another year or another three. And I always say remove that and make it go month-to-month after my term. And you can do the same thing on your data center space as well, right? So that's like a common one that they expect everybody to change for the most part. There's a few situations where we've seen where people didn't want that. They actually wanted the auto renewal, and that would be like government organizations. A lot of times they wanted to see auto renewals because if they had to re-sign a contract, they had to go back to committee and do all this crap. But if it auto renewed, it just, like, they didn't have to think about it. So I've seen it in those instances. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. And that's kind of what I'm seeing with the, like, contract that I was looking at. I was like, man, there's a lot of stuff in here that doesn't make any sense for, like, what the heck is that? Yeah. So that makes sense. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to sign off.
Hey, bud.
I have another commitment I need to get off to. I really appreciate that it's a topic that I was asking about. And it's like, oh, dang, I hate to leave. But I really appreciate the info, and I will definitely be listening to the whole bloody podcast.
Well, heaven forbid you have something to do on a Saturday, so shame on you.
Don't worry, I don't mind being late. She's only a 7
out of 10. Don't talk about your mom like that.
Oh, no, mom's always a 10 out of 10.
All right, take care, bud. Yeah,
take care, guys.
So back to that, like, on a contract, everything is negotiable. Like, every line on there. Those dudes will, like, if you look at those data center contracts, they'll indemnify themselves from everything, right? Which basically means if anything ever happens, we're not responsible for it. Yeah, so it's crazy what they'll try and slip through.
For sure.
On that power thing, I think we're paying probably somewhere around $800 a month for power in Chicago Equinix, and we're using a combined 5 or 6 amps.
Yeah, there you go.
But they don't sell anything.
You know what's interesting is
A and B, that's
a data center can't technically sell you power. Did you know that? Because to sell power, you have to be a co-op, right? You have to be a producer or like an exchange, like one of those intermediaries or whatever. And so data center groups aren't that. So they're really just selling you, they'll all use the interesting language, like, I'm selling you capacity, or I'm selling you a whip rental fee, right? They're not actually selling you power.
Sure. Some of the big, like, hyperscale guys, which doesn't make any sense, like, you know, like the Facebooks and the Googles, some of them have become their own regulated power utility. For advantages, not for this, because there are no
They're not reselling
customers to serve, but but they've done that, I suppose, to get greater control over the power that comes to them.
I mean, yeah, we're talking about public colo versus private, and those guys, you know, when you're the one of the biggest countries, or rather, biggest companies in the world with the most money, you've definitely got pull. You know, you're gonna. I mean, those jokers. I mean, some of those guys manufacture their own chipsets and stuff, right?
Yeah.
So that's just they're on a whole different level. They don't even exist on our radar. Like, I don't count those buggers.
That's another world.
On the Facebook data center going in just up the street from me. The substation that they're building for the campus. They're going to be building one data center right now, but you know, the substation is as large as the primary substation serving these 60 or 70,000 people in this area. Yeah. Just for one building.
You know what's right interesting now? Too? Here's a little tidbit that you just made me think about is power shedding. So data centers, at least here in the States, I don't know if they do that over in NZ or AU, where you are, Thrift, but here in the States, we have really, I think there's like, there's only like three power grids. Everything else is like, everything is really super connected. Texas has their own. I think most of America has one, and I think there's maybe one more kind of diversified off somewhere in North America.
It's east and west. I'm not sure where the line is, but you know, it's
so
state by state here.
So one of the things we do here is we have this thing called load shedding. So during peak times, like in the summer, you know, when it's at its hottest, that's generally when we have kind of peak power utilization. That's when like California will have rolling blackouts and wacky stuff like that. Well, what they do is you can sign up for this ERCOT response program. And so you become a member of that if you're like a high power user. So a lot of data centers do it. And they'll sign up for that. And ERCOT will give them an emergency test. They don't know when it's going to happen. They kind of roughly know like a month time frame. They'll call them and they have, I believe, 10 minutes to shed load, which basically means they go on generator, right? So they take as much of their load off of the utility as they can and run on generator. If they pass, they're good for like a year. If they fail, I think they get one retest and then they're off the program if they fail again. But the idea being, at any point in time during the year, like they're about to hit peak, well, they can call the data center and say, okay, you need to go on generator. Well, it's not, they don't really call. It's like a mass notification that goes out, and you have to run on generator for however long it takes. And then once they give you the all clear, you can go back on utility. But the government pays organizations to be part of that program. So you can make hundreds of thousands of dollars to not do anything. You basically
can pay for your generators.
Yeah, you pass the test, and then they're going to send you, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year just for the idea that you may be able to go on generator if needed. So I thought that was an interesting little plus for data centers.
Also, on those lines, some of the data centers, you know, it's like a Facebook or a Google or something where, you know, they control A to Z. In similar situations, they will just move the compute load to a different region of the country so that, you know, they don't go on generator or anything. They just, all right, we'll just, you know, move all of the messenger traffic out of this facility, and you know, we'll do it all out of South Carolina instead.
Facebook can do that like easily, but an enterprise might not be able to do it so easily.
Yeah,
like a, you know, Facebook, Amazon, you know, Google types, you know, they can do it. And I believe I've heard them do presentations where, you know, they will, you know, they have teams that just go and just turn shit off. You know, someone just goes in and just flips the main breaker for the whole facility. What happens? And they, you know, they make sure that their diversity and whatnot, you know, works because they just manually turned off this whole data center.
I've seen where, like, call centers that go dark overnight, they'll have scripts that connect to, like, their PoE switches and shut off all the phones overnight. Right, to save electricity.
I've seen that as well.
Yeah. So let's see. The next section I have in here is all about connectivity. So I'm assuming most of the folks listening to this, you're probably network guys. You're probably going in to get connectivity, right? So Mike runs an IX, so he's in all these various places, right? The idea is you can go in there. You can find either DIA from a carrier. You can start peering with people on an exchange. You know, it's just... you have options, right? We've talked multiple times about why you would go into a data center. But when you're going in there, what are the things you're going to look out for? What are the questions you want to ask? What are the things you're going to try and negotiate your way through all this stuff. So whenever you go into a data center, you can sometimes buy space. You know, you can buy, some data centers will sell it to you by the U, right? So I can buy 1 U, 2 U, 3, you know, whatever you need. Some will sell it to you by chunks. So like a third of a cabinet, a half a cabinet, you can go full cabinet, you can buy a full cage, right? So there's various sizes of, I guess, just space that you can get in there. But once you get in, how do you actually get a connection? And in the data center, it's called a cross connect. So there's also fees associated with said cross connects. There's fees associated with everything, guys. So,
and that's where data centers make most of their profit.
That is where the majority of their profit comes from. You are good and correct, sir. So whenever I was working at the data center, I was VP of technology, so I took care of all the IT stuff, and cross connects fell under my my profit center. So guess who was doing really well? And there was a point in time where there was like 1.5 employees in my department. So the cost to profit ratio was really high for me for a while there. But yeah, so you can go into a data center. I've got my space. Now I need a cross connect. So a lot of data centers will sell you DIA, right? They'll sell you internet connection. A lot of them will sell it to you redundantly as well, right? They'll hand you two feeds. They're either going to give that to you redundancy with a protocol like a first hop protocol like VRRP or HSRP, right? Where you have kind of a first hop gateway that will fail over between. You can also do BGP with customers, or rather with the data center, right? That was really common. Even if you don't have your own address space, if you just wanted to do it for redundancy, we would do it. And some data centers will charge you for BGP. Most won't. So just kind of your mileage may vary. Watch out for that. I know there's some carriers that do it too. Like by default, Cogent will charge you an extra little fee if you want a BGP peer with them, which is bonkers to me. I guess it's like
$50 per BGP session.
I guess it's like a cross connect fee, right? It's it's basically something they invented to make more money. But while we're talking about cross connects, You can get a copper connection or a fiber connection. Copper connections are generally cheaper. I'm not saying that's across the board, but all the data centers I've dealt with, copper cross connects were always cheaper. And then you have fiber in data centers. I've only ever seen single mode connections. I've never seen anybody sell you a multi-mode connection from a carrier to you as far as cross. I mean, I see people use multi-mode inside their cabinets, you know, like in between their piece of equipment and their local cabinet, but I've never seen it go from them to a carrier. So anticipate single mode in those instances, but they will charge you more. I've seen cross connects on fiber be anywhere from $150, maybe $100 a month to $400 a month, right? So your mileage may vary on that stuff. And Tommy asked, why is the price, why is there a price on cross connects? I thought that was,
it's pure gravy.
I was like, you sweet summer child. the seedy underbelly of the data center. Yeah, it is. It's, so generally there's an install charge, and they're going to really, what they're doing is they're recouping, the engineer's time to run the cross connect and materials, right? Because a fiber jumper isn't that much. Most data centers use zone patching, and what that means is from central points where carriers are going to be, or suite to suite, or pod to pod, whatever the nomenclature happens to be, from the pop rooms to the whatever, they've got infrastructure that already exists with patch panels just sitting there, right? They have trunks going in between everything. And then whenever you order a cross connect, they're just putting little jumpers in, right? Jumpers that are like probably $5 a piece. They pull them out of a plastic bag, and then they label them, and they plug, and then they plug in your cabinet, and you're good to go. So that's usually how the turnups are pretty fast. It adds a lot of consistency, right? It's very repeatable, easy to document. So very seldom will people do home runs for anything like one-offs. I know when we first got it started at Fibertown, that's what we were doing. Just because we didn't have a lot of budget, but shortly thereafter we switched to do the zone cabling part. But if you think about it, a trunk doesn't cost that much. Fiber store patch panels are pretty inexpensive, So that stuff, you recoup the cost really quickly on that. So it really is gravy. They are just, I mean, that is pure profit is all that is. But you know what? They didn't start that data center to be a monastery. You know, they're they're in it to make money. So it's not, I'm not faulting them, right? It fed my kids for a long time.
I have noticed that generally speaking, not always, but generally, in the bigger the company, the more they likely are to charge for the cross connect. So if you have a little 1, 2, 3, 4 data center company, they may not even charge anything, or it may be a one-time charge, you know, $500 to have the guy go do it. We've got a few data centers where there's zero cost. You submit a plan, and then they approve or deny the plan. Well, since we've, you know, proven ourselves competent, we don't even have to do that anymore. We just go. Obviously, when you're choosing your data center, that's something to keep in mind. You know, do I go to Equinix Chicago to be at the premier facility in the Midwest for connectivity, where it costs me $350 a month for every cross connect? Or do I go to Indianapolis or St. Louis or Milwaukee or Minneapolis, you know, some other second tier market that's still good, but, you know, I, you know, all depending upon what you're doing, you know, if you've got two, you know, diverse, you know, transport circuits going back to your network, and you have two transits and an IX, that's five circuits. That's $1,500 a month in cross connects.
Yeah, stuff starts adding up quick. It's fewer and fewer that you'll find a data center that will give you free cross connects. I haven't seen one for a while, so you're doing pretty good. But you are right. The smaller vendors seem to be a little bit more flexible on that.
I've been in data centers where there was no monthly fee for the cross connects, but you had to pay to establish one. Now, the thing I did notice there, though, is their cross connects were a mess because you weren't paying for it. So when you didn't need it anymore, you never canceled it. You never let them know. So there was just mountains of cabling running between the rows. And I'd say half of it was unused. It was just pretty bad. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, that is, that is so bad. And data centers, I could tell you, don't want to remove infrastructure because it is dangerous. You know, every time they go and touch a patch panel, there's a chance they're going to screw something up, especially if they're trying to remove infrastructure. What they would do is, you don't try and salvage a link. You cut the ends off, leaving the label, and you carefully snake that joker out of there. You know what I mean? Because it's, you don't want to have to explain why you took somebody down. Right, or a large customer. And those bigger customers, sometimes we talked about the contract is negotiable. I've seen some big boys put internet connectivity as part of their SLA for their entire monthly spend. So some people would have, if their network infrastructure goes down, if one of your guys jacks a cross connect for, and it takes you 30 minutes to suss it out, you may be giving that customer their whole month payment back on all of their spend. And nobody wants that to happen. So, you know what? It's honestly safer to just abandon that thing in place than it is to risk something like that. So I definitely see why some people would do it.
At Equinix, and I think this is also pretty common with most of the big guys, they actually have a moratorium from like November 1st through January 1st, just ballparking, for any access to major parts of their infrastructure. So, like, you know, if one of those trunk lines you mentioned earlier is, you know, runs out of capacity,
you're out of luck. We would go into change freezes, you know, for sure on no major. But then we also had some insurance companies that at like those, there would be like 2 week periods where everybody would be like renewing, whatever that is, you know, like you hit the certain time of year and you've got, open enrollment. At open enrollment, they would always, we actually had enough big insurance customers where sometimes we would go into change freezes just for them so that we wouldn't like screw up anything. Cause I remember one organization was telling us that like every 45 minutes they were processing like $2.5 million or something like that, or maybe it was every 30 minutes, I don't know, like that was like day and night. So they were like, if you touch anything we're gonna basically murder you. So you know, it was you know, and that's, you know, it's easy to say, okay, fine, we just won't break anything for a little bit and you just sort of wait. But while we're talking about cross connects and the price of cross connects, there is no standard. It really, I found, it seems to be kind of whatever your area is, everybody sort of settles in, unless you're like a monster provider like Equinix. Then those guys, I don't know where they come up with their numbers. It doesn't seem to be like market dependent. They're always just really expensive. I think because they have such good connectivity, they know you want in there. They know they, you know, they've got you. So
it's that and all of the big customers, you know, they're paying less than 20% probably of what you're paying for it. So they have to charge you more to get the money they want. Because like when we were trying to get that rack in Chicago, I was mentioning earlier, Zayo had a deal with Equinix where they were going to start, you know, reselling some of their stuff. And even at the rate that Zayo was paying, plus their markup, was still like a third less than if we were to pay Equinix direct. And it's just like, so there's, so they have enough discount built in.
And that definitely brings up a good point, is that whenever possible, I ask everybody. I ask everybody, what can you do for me, right? So if you're going into a facility and you're trying to get connectivity from a specific carrier, ask them, what are your cross-connect rates? If they, they'll usually tell you what they pay. And on top of that, a lot of times I would say, hey, could you order the cross connect for me? So while my price may have been $300 a month, theirs was $75 a month, and they were happy to just order that cross connect and roll it into my monthly. So you could save a ton of money if you just ask those guys to do that stuff. On top of that, some of those guys, you can actually put your kit in their space. So instead of paying an exorbitant price to pull dedicated power and space, you can actually just go in there. And I would also say MSPs. So if there's any managed service providers in that facility, call those guys up, because odds are they'll let you put, they'll let you take up a few U, right? And they'll sell you a little bit of power and you're going to pay a fraction of the price. You'll still get the AP power. And like you said, Mike, if they're bigger, they probably got a better negotiated rate on cross-connect fees. So they'll actually probably be able to save you money in that regard too. But ask everybody for pricing. Ask everybody what they're paying. Find other people.
And if you're in like a, you know, instant also space in one of those big data centers, you know, you might be able to knock out one of your DIAs by just buying your DIA from them. Then there is no cross connect. Usually, you know, for mostly types of companies, you know, most of it, of the content hosting type companies, are pushing their bandwidth out, so their inbound pipes are empty in comparison. And so then, you know, then you get a better deal. Because you are an eyeball network, and so it doesn't cost them anything either. So they'll sell to you for
Something I'd also say is a lot of folks would come in to get network connectivity, and they would find the cheapest carrier they could. And you know, it's like I don't blame you. You know, they just need to get to the, you know, to the content or whatever. So I would always recommend, hey, every data center you go into has their own bandwidth. They're going to try and sell it to you, right? They're not going to charge you cross connect fees. They'll probably give you redundant connectivity. And most of them will do 95th percentile billing. So I would say, look, just pull a connection from us, from them, you know, whoever the data center happened to be, get it as a backup link on 95th percentile. So really, if you don't use it, you're not paying for it. And if you need to use it, you're going to be really glad it's there, right? If your primary connection that's really cheap fails, it's better to take, you know, an extra, you know, $500 or $600 payment 1 month than have all those customers pissed off at you, or potentially pay out SLAs on those customers.
Yeah, one thing I will say that you've just reminded me, if you're in shared racks, you should factor in the fact that someone is going to disconnect your power cables, or is going to snag your network cables, or is going to turn your equipment off. So just be prepared for that, because every time I've put equipment in shared racks, that has happened at some point.
And also, you may have trouble getting to that, right? So like if it's a carrier's racks and they're letting you put stuff in there, they may not let you go in there and touch it yourself, right? There might be extra hoops to jump through. So if something goes wrong, it might take you a half a day before you can get in there and have anything done. So kind of keep that in mind too. If you're not the customer of record, most data centers aren't going to work with you, right? They're not going to take your phone call. You're not paying them, so they're not obliged to waste their time on you. So that's something else to keep in mind. Let's see, what else? Bandwidth. If you're looking for bandwidth, call every provider that's in there. Just see what they'll do, right? Pit these guys against each other. Why not? What else can you do as far as bandwidth goes? Call a local circuit reseller. Sometimes those guys will have information you don't, right? So if there's a WISP that happens to be in there pulling connectivity, I've done this before, those guys will sell you bandwidth pennies on the dollar compared to anybody else in there. So if you just need some cheap, dirty bandwidth, call one of those dudes. I bet you they'll hook you up. Pretty inexpensive. And while we're talking about cross-connects, when you're first going in, I generally negotiate at least one free cross-connect when I'm going in to any facility. That may not seem like a lot, but that, you know, $200, that's $2,400 a year you're saving. So, I mean, that makes a big difference, especially for the WISPs that are listening to this, right? $2,400 could be make or break on whether you can actually afford to go into a data center. So think about that. Remember, everything's negotiable. So just ask for the moon if you can.
Sure, yet, and sometimes you'll find operators that, you know, may be friendly with you that have purchased more than they need and will you know, let you in on their circuit. I may or may not know of someone in Chicago that has excess capacity and is doing just that.
Hosting providers are actually sometimes really good sources for bandwidth, because as Mike said, the content providers, all their bandwidth is going out the door, whereas you want to be, you know, as an eyeball network, I'm going to be pulling bandwidth, right? So your traffic's going to be inverse of what they have, so they're definitely going to want to take advantage of that.
Yeah, one thing I've learned is no matter how friendly you are with another provider, make sure you have a contract.
Yes.
Because they could change ownership, yes. And if they change ownership, you won't be as friendly with the next owner.
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding. And then the next owner will see the position that you find yourself in, and they'll take advantage of it and then start charging you for
Definitely.
It.
Yeah. Or if you're getting cheap rack space from them, they might ask you to move out of the rack very quickly, as I have recently seen and had to help someone move racks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely, yeah. Get it in writing if you can. Let's see. Find resellers inside of DCs. Also, carriers I've talked to, carriers have actually helped me find connectivity from various people. So don't be afraid to just ask the guys you're talking to, hey, do you know somebody that can do this? Hey, do you know another source I can get a good connection from? So I've, Talia, Kirk Tracy, I think is his name, was my sales rep. And he actually, in some various facilities, helped me find like hosting providers that you can pull cheap connectivity from. Obviously, they were one of his customers as well. But, you know, if he couldn't get the sell, he was going to make sure one of his customers could. And so, you know, ask around. Just ask. It's ask everybody for pricing. You know, all they can say is no. Or, you know, you might actually get some intel that's going to be usable. So definitely ask around. If you're ever curious to find out, at least at some spots in the States, I don't know what it's like over there, or in Europe, it's probably harder in Europe, but everybody who leases colo space, at least in Texas, I know, they have to pay property tax on the space they lease, believe it or not. So all you have to do is look them up on the tax records for that address, and you can find everybody that's in the data center, the legal name for every company that's in there. So Whoa. If you aren't sure what MSPs are in there or what hosting providers are in there, guess what? It's super easy. It usually takes about 5 minutes. You could pull the entire list. So I'm sure you can understand how data centers mine the competition from each other. It's really super easy to do. Yeah. Because the government definitely wants to get their taste of those people putting that stuff in there. I had some of my personal stuff in a data center, and I get a bill from the tax district for like, I think it was like $15,000 in taxes. And they were like, yeah, yeah, we didn't have you on record, so we just estimated what you were using. I said, I've got one server in there. I was like, I got it off of eBay. It was like $150. They're like, oh, well, that doesn't even qualify for us to like send you a bill, so never mind.
Not with
yeah,
that time.
Yeah, I had to contest it. So it's like, sometimes if you don't tell them what you're worth, they're going to make up a number, and you're going to get this little interesting surprise in the mail. So you look out for that for sure. But yeah, that's something people don't think too, right? If I go into a data center, I have to pay property tax. That's not what you would expect.
That's crazy.
But, don't mention that to the state of Illinois. We pay no taxes. That is not,
I was gonna say, I don't anticipate it being the same for all areas, but it is down here. All right, what else do I have on here?
I'm gonna have to jump off, guys. I've got family commitments.
Gotcha. Well, I think we're pretty much at the end of the list anyway. All right, but yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was all of the stuff on my list. All right, let's put a fork in it, man. We're at like an hour and a half, so you sacrificed enough time to defend your honor, Andrew. So all we have to do is just keep putting words in your mouth, and you'll keep showing up. Noted.
That's how it works.
I was going to make that claim. It's just keep getting things wrong that Thrift tells us, and then he'll have to come on and correct it, and then that's how we get him on.
Do a small rage. I'll be on more anyway now. I've got a better setup here. Still good.
Yeah, dude, it's looking good. You're sounding good. Everything looks clean. I heard your interesting awesome birds this morning. That was fun.
It was quiet today. You should hear them during the week. It was terrible.
All right. Well, Andrew Thrift, thank you for joining. If people want to get a hold of you out on the internet, how do they go about that?
LinkedIn is the easiest way. Yeah. You can look me up on there. Just Andrew Thrift. You'll find me pretty easy.
Excellent. He's the guy with the amazing hair. Mike Hammett, if people want to get a hold of you out on the internet, how do they do that?
Patreon.com/thebrotherswisp. Go there. Someone else will help.
Rock and roll. If you want to find me, I'm at gregsoul.com. It's greg@gregsoul.com. You can send me an email, or you can find me in the Slack, and that's patreon.com/thebrotherswisp. You toss a couple of bones, you get access to the patron-only Slack that is hopping. It's been quiet the last couple of days, but it's ebbs and flows. It's picking back up. We're getting busy in there. So jump in, contribute, or just lurk, you know, whatever's good. We just got a new guy, Travis. It's based off that QuickBit podcast we did. That guy just casually dropped a little fact that he pushes like 120 gigs at peak every night. So that's, it's like, oh, okay. Well, that's a different level.
It's a lot.
Walked into the room and went.
He dropped several mics simultaneously. Yeah. So it's pretty awesome, dude. And then so it's the tiniest of people like me all the way up to the big boys like that. So jump in. Your voice is definitely important. Thank you, guys. Questions, comments, keep them coming. Thank you, guests, Thrift, Tommy C, even though you're gone, and Mike Hammett. We'll see you guys next time.
See ya.
Stop. And then I come over here and I click stop.
Just give us a listen, because fun is the mission. I'm telling you, you don't know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry, you're forgiven.